Hey everyone, my name is Gagan Kalra. I'm your host at IT. And today we have a really special session. We have one of the pioneers in the field of ophthalmology, really just medicine, when it comes to advancing the field of medical informatics. And with this great work, I'm sure you're all going to be blown away. So hang tight. I hope you're all sipping on your favorite beverage. We at IT obviously are a little biased towards tea, but you could be having a mocha or a coffee, whatever is your favorite drink. And, you know, the idea behind IT has always been trying to have impromptu conversations as if I had run into, you know, one of our guests at a conference and recreate that experience so that you can experience that virtually and have a peek into the lives of some of the pioneers in ophthalmology. Well, without further ado, I am going to introduce our guest today. We have a true luminary in the field of ophthalmology, Dr. Michael Abramoff. As a distinguished retina specialist and a groundbreaking researcher and successful entrepreneur, he's left an indelible mark in the field of medicine and innovation. He's a fellowship-trained retina specialist, of course, and a computer scientist, as well as a dual background, and also an entrepreneur. He's the founder and executive chairman of Digital Diagnostics. That's the company that received the first FDA clearance for an autonomous AI diagnostic system in medicine. So to transform the quality, accessibility, and affordability of global healthcare has been the mission of this company. And, you know, again, Dr. Abramoff has really been the front and centerpiece of making it happen. He also holds a professorship, the Sir Robert C. Watke Professorship in Ophthalmology at the University of Iowa. It's also a joint appointment with the College of Engineering over there. So it really, again, bringing together the fields of medicine and the expertise from the engineering background there and just really making it happen. So I already mentioned about his executive chairman role at Digital Diagnostics, but I think it really cannot be understated that how amazing it is that some of the groundbreaking work in medicine in terms of autonomous AI is coming first to ophthalmology, and that too coming through this company. I am personally a big fan of Dr. Abramoff's work, and he's had over 300 peer-reviewed publications, over 46,000 citations, something along those lines, approaching 47,000. Really an inspiration for me and many others. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Abramoff.
Hey, it's so nice meeting you, Governor. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Just so we have a quick outline of what we're going to talk about, we will divide this hour into 20-minute segments, and then we'll talk about different aspects of this deep dive that's our new series with IT. So we are able to talk about different things along your journey and how you've come from the beginning. I think without further ado, I would like to start with our first part, which is your life story. I am just dying to know personally, and I'm sure our listeners as well. How did you find your path in terms of having a double background also, and then finding ophthalmology, and how you've clubbed that together with informatics?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question to start with. Do not do this at home, okay? It's not worth repeating, but I will tell you what I did so you can avoid, and the listeners can avoid doing it themselves. But I was coming out of high school and, you know, medical school. I was, as you can hear from my accent, trained in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam. Did medical school, was also excited about computers. I'm old, so we're talking late 80s. And computers and personal computers just start coming out. It's not like today, right? Yeah. And that always excited me, and programming excited me, even as a high school student when I was 14, 15, 16. And so I was doing medical school. I realized, well, maybe there's other things you can do with computers, having to do with medicine. Took a long and circuitous route through medical school, getting an engineering, computer engineering degree, ultimately working in the software industry for a while in Japan and later in France, but really focused on what you now call a tech career, right?
Yeah.
And the big examples were not like the FANG companies like Facebook, Apple, et cetera. It was the IBMs and the Microsofts were the big examples that people tried to emulate in some way. But that's a different era. Still, the itch was there to help patients and do something about patient care and improve that. And so ultimately, and when I heard my fellow medical students getting their residencies and be really excited about practicing medicine, the itch came back. I went back to medicine, did my residency in ophthalmology. It's all story why ophthalmology, but it's just, I love microsurgery. I love getting my hands dirty. I love the type of scientific evidence that you have in ophthalmology. And we'll get back to that later. You know, yeah. Why ophthalmology, why retina? And in my view, it's this awesome scientific evidence that we have in our field. That really was an important point because I had this background in computer science, but also more importantly in what I call neuroscience, where, and especially in Japan, we were starting to emulate or mimic small neural networks with several neurons in computers. This is the first era, really. First was single layer, two layer neural networks.
And this is back in, this is back.
We're talking 89.
89. Wow. Yeah. It's really the beginning.
Well, I met LeCun. I was still a researcher, unknown, just like I was. Yeah, those were the days. But it was not more than that. It was really, you do brain slices, you see how these cells behave, you measure electrical impulses and spike patterns, and see how what you think is relevant can be mimicked and whether it has to do with synapses or with action potentials, etc. So a lot of work. But with that back in mind, I thought, whether I was a resident, and particularly I saw these diabetes patients, which as a resident, we probably all see. So either they come to us, and it's still the case, too late when they have all sorts of complications and proliferative retinopathy and maybe a detachment here or there, some membranes, really never screened, you know, the type of patient. And you have these very conscientious patients who essentially maybe a type 1, A1C of 5, take great care of themselves. You know, they're always perfect. And you say, well, come back next year.
Yes.
And so they're very little in between. And they realized, well, hey, maybe we can make this better by having computers do what I'm doing so I can focus really on the more difficult cases. And also we can get more people into these diabetic eye exams, which at the time we already knew was important, right? It was not like we're really talking the early ETTRS, DRS, those are sold by even by that time. So we knew you need to do diabetic eye exams, but clearly, as you saw in practice, we're not happening. I thought, well, maybe a computer can do this. Telemedicine was on the upswing. People thought that was going to be the solution. I was more excited about doing it with a computer. So during my residency, I did literally a PhD in what we now call artificial intelligence or machine learning. When I started my vitreo retinal surgery fellowship, I was still doing that, finished that within my fellowship, finished that and realized that to train guys, you really need a lot of data. That was not available. This was the era where we were still skinning slides to get data, right? Camera that is digital with the CMOS was just starting to appear, especially in Europe, maybe in the US, it was a few years earlier, but not much. And so I realized I need more images. I set up a telemedicine project, you know, to bring the service to patients, but more importantly, to get the images. And that was key because that was such important data for training and validating and testing all these different algorithms that we're developing at the time. Ultimately, ended up in the US, got some funding from NIH, several R1s. Continue to work on what I call really important was autonomous AI. And we'll probably get back to the term also.
Yes.
The environment where I was doing AI was mostly focused around radiology. And there's a lot of assistive AI for various reasons that I don't want to go into right now. But anyway, assistive AI means that the radiologist makes the decision. And then maybe is he or she is advised by the AI, hey, here's a nodule, here's a calcification, you can look more carefully at that. Not the medical decision being made by the algorithm.
Right.
For ophthalmology, I didn't really see the utility of that. It is really about getting the eye exams to the patients where they are. I mean, clearly the barrier is coming, not what you do. And so I know how to do an eye exam, right? As a professional. And so I was really focused on autonomous AI. It was interesting because I ran into some, when I presented data at conferences in maybe 2010, 2011, there was a little bit of pushback. Ultimately, you know, once you started publishing, and you may have heard about this, the big editorial by my friend, Pete McDonald, who's the chair of ophthalmology at Wilmer. And he did this editorial on the front page of the Ophthalmology Times, The Retinator, A Revenge of the Machines. Somewhat tongue-in-cheek, somewhat serious. Hey, this is going to cost us jobs. This is going to affect negatively the quality of care. And that was not a good moment in my life. It turned out to be a really good moment later, but was not
at the time.
Here you are doing your science and thinking you're benefiting mankind. And now, wow, you called a retinator, you know, the terminator of the retina. Got a call from my chair, you know, hey, what's going on there? I was trying to make tenure at the time, I can imagine. And so that made me realize, and you asked a personal story, but so it linked to what we have been doing as a company, as a field, that there are these concerns now that people have, and pure science and just doing scientific papers will not be enough to get this to patients. you need to address the wider concerns that exist in society. I will get back to that. But anyway, there was an important point. Happy to found a company. Took a while, went to FDA and said, hey, I want a computer to make a diagnosis. And FDA, as they should, said, whoa, not so fast. Let's talk a bit. Very fruitful collaboration. We talked for 8 years, designed how you do a clinical trial for autonomous AI. Are the transparency standards, what is the threshold for sensitivity and specificity, the accuracy that you need to see? What about racial netting bias? You know, all the things that people now are really paying attention to. We had to think about, carefully address, and so have comfort on both sides. And that collaboration continues to this day. So maybe you see my title that I'm also the executive secretary of what is called the Healthcare AI Coalition. That's a group of pure AI companies that interacts with Congress, with different agencies on AI in healthcare and how to regulate it, how to reimburse it, how to legislate it, and all these aspects. But also, I work very closely in what is called a collaborative community, which is a mechanism for FDA to be able to interact directly with companies, with ethicists, with patient organizations, with clinicians, with scientists on, in this case, AI, and especially AI in ophthalmology and optometry. And where I run what is called the foundational principles of AI, where we try to use an ethical framework, and we can get back to that, how we publish that. How we use an ethical framework to create a regulatory rule, say, for AI. And that's really exciting to me. And how you can measure ethics, because to me, ethics before was always this thing, you get it in medical school, and you maybe get it, hopefully you get it in your residency. And there's a lot of words, but as an engineer, you want to measure things like the...
Make it objective.
You know, am I 80% ethical or 90% ethical? Well, they can tell you that. They just say, do this thing. And I say, I'm going to be ethical, of course. What else are you going to say?
Right.
And so we did something about that. And you still see that with some tech companies where they have these, I happen to go off track about the wider field rather than my personal story. We'll get back to that, I promise.
Yeah.
But you see these bigger tech companies having these ethical committees, right? And then sort of external expert, they discuss ethics. They usually fight a lot and then it gets into the press and makes you look bad. And they tell the engineers in the company, hopefully, to be ethical. But I don't know. And so we do it differently because we say, well, you need to be measuring these different aspects of an ethical principle, like autonomy of the patient or equity or justice. And how do you do that? And how can you measure software, how much it is aligned with a certain ethical principle? And that's something that is actionable, right? That where you can do something.
100%.
So I love that part of how we do it and how other companies are not doing it. So back to working with FDA continues to the day, working later on this ethical frameworks, for example, liability, who's liable for the performance of the AI? So we probably get back to that. And to solve all of that, ended up, for example, about racial bias, ended up doing studies in Kenya to see whether performance held up in the more darkly pigmented patients. Just a really fascinating subject, but you know, that we published that in, I think, 2013. So we're very early on trying to address all these concerns that at the time, especially regulatory agencies like FDA have. 2018 was the big moment after the clinical trial the year before. Yeah. Got what is called approval, but formally the FDA required me to say the de novo authorization, right?
Yeah.
It's a very strict definition. But anyway, that was really exciting. It proved that it's safe, effective, free of racial and ethnic bias. Really exciting moment. And of course, with every step you think, oh, you know, now we're done, right? Now it can get to patients, right? You need to do the science. Well, where's the regulatory work? And as soon as we had that, I literally got a call the same day. I was in clinic when I heard it, if I remember correctly. But anyway, they chased me through the hospital because the CEO of a big, I won't say more than that, a big retail company wanted to speak to me because they wanted to use this AI in their setting. And we talked about, I was very excited, and he said, how about reimbursement? Well, no one had done that, right? And, when you went to payers, they said, well, why didn't you get the FDA approval first? Everyone is saying FDA approval, not me. I wouldn't do that. Everyone else is saying FDA. And so I said, well, no, not today, but you know, give me a moment, right?
Yes.
We immediately pivoted, started working on how do you do that? So we actually created a framework based in ethics on how much should you charge for an AI like this?
Yeah.
You can read up on that. It's a paper last year. And I think that really helped CMS and other payers. There's actually payers as co-authors on that paper, as well as people from the RUC, right, who very deeply involved in reimbursement.
Okay. But anyway, I'm going to find the paper. I'm going to attach it to
it. What is it, a chat? Oh, sure.
So that is great for our listeners to also follow along. And certainly, I think I love the interesting stories that you have and how it has evolved. You know, your interest first started with the imaging and then the artificial intelligence, the neural networks. And then from there, it evolved towards more softer topics like, say, ethics or making it something that's financially stable. How do you pay and all of that? I think that's an interesting, as third person, you know, listening to it from the outside, it's the observation I make is that it's a great evolution in terms of your interest and how that has shaped your career. I think that's fascinating. And certainly I would love to hear a little bit more about all of those little tiny details in the subsequent parts of our podcast. But just a quick question that I wanted to interject at this stage was, were there any specific mentors that you feel like played a big role in shaping your interest and maybe giving you your moment or break so that you can actually, you know, be on the stage and do the experiments?
Yeah, I've been asked that before. So I stand on the shoulder of giants, and the giants in the field of ophthalmology and retina are just amazing. Bob Watsky being one of them, right? I'm very proud to be the Watsky professor. But it was never about direct interaction. It was more about being inspired by them and reading up on them and why they did the science they did away. And when I met them I'm a Macula Society member. When you meet them there, you're just, you know, awed. And I still am. So it's more like that than them telling me to do, hey, why did you do this or that? Yeah. It's really nothing like that. So it's more in respiration. But that includes Hubel and Wiesel, right? Visual cortex, or John von Neumann, or McCulloch and Pitts. There's so many of these influences, and I admire those examples and those inspirations, and you read up on them, how they did science and how they looked out sometimes.
Yeah.
More than having someone who took me by the hand to say, hey, you know, which sometimes I try to be a mentor for newer people, and I tell them, hey, maybe you should do a series of papers on this rather than that, or that will help you with a grant proposal. That type of thing, I really got a little bit less of, which is fine.
Yeah.
I probably listened anyway. So,
yeah. That's incredible. Thanks for sharing those names. I think certainly the inspiration is key, right? Because that's the thing that drives you, be like, hey, I want to be like them or even better, or use that motivation towards your goals then after that. Yeah. I think that's really important. And many of our listeners are trainees who are trying to find that drive. And I think looking around into the community and finding people who really inspire you can spark that interest. And maybe you'll like that topic now because you like that person, right?
True.
So now you will develop that interest. So thank you for sharing that. And I gotta say, when you shared that story about that editorial, how did that feel? Like in that moment, you must feel so, what were your feelings?
It was a bit brutal because I think my story in a nutshell is, how do you get it from the science to the patient?
Yes.
And it's a long story. And I thought, well, here I'm doing all the science. Like, you get told, well, if you just, no one really told me this. My impression as a naive physician scientist was, if you do the science right, people will say, wow, this is so logical. We need to do this.
Yes.
But that is not at all how it works. But so this was just a hurdle of, wow, you do the science right, and people now are pushing back for different reasons. And they should, and I'm glad they do. And that sort of crystallized this feeling that, A, you cannot be reactive all the time to new concerns. It's better to be proactive. Uh-huh. How do you deal with that? Well, that's why I started digging into ethics and an ethical framework, because I think it's really important to address these concerns proactive rather than when they come out. So as an example, I like to get a social media for younger people where, you know, there's no evidence of harm being done. And we just started doing this and we didn't think about the consequences, and now we see harm doing. And now we're being reactive to that, right? To say, well, maybe at a certain age or whatever. I was worried about the backlash you would get for so many benefits. And you've seen it in gene therapy, where gene therapy was very promising. Young people were included in trials genetically. People died and it was shut down for decades. And only, again, in retina, Luxturna was approved in 2017. With maybe a 20-year delay because of ethics, right? So if you work on ethics, you can sort of predict what concerns will be coming out rather than respond to them one by one and say, well, actually, we didn't mean it this way. That is too risky and may lead to a shutdown. For me, that was logical that ethics was the next step and that we need to address this. And then you get to, well, you read all these ethics texts and it's, yeah, this is logical and that is logical and that makes sense. That makes sense, but it's not actionable.
Right. It's,
from an engineering perspective, you know, I have these three lines of code and how are these lines ethical or not? And how is it contextualized? And so, yeah, that was interesting work, I think. But that it really led to that I don't want this to happen again. Right. So that was good. But at the time, it was just painful, very painful.
No, I understand. Thanks for sharing how you thought about that and dissected that beautifully for all of us to understand. I think this is a great segue into our second theme.
You're listening to the three-part series with Dr. Michael Abramoff. If you've been enjoying this, please watch out for more episodes. Thank you.
If you want more IT-related content, follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Also, find us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast. Search for E by E T E A I T.